History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. They don't have to go untold if we'll take that initiative to ask a few questions and invest some time in listening. We're always going to end up receiving more than we could have imagined. At least that's been my experience over the last 20 years. Our goal here has always been to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in return, we're educated, we're always entertained, and we really do end up inspired by these stories from our men and women in uniform. The gentleman we get to hear from today grew up in Normal, Illinois, but his military experiences were anything but normal. Greg Schiffbauer is the author of the newly released book, First Shot, detailing some of his experience in special operations during the Vietnam War. Like so many veterans, he kept his memories to himself for decades. But his honor flight to Washington, D.C. has made it a little easier to discuss some of the things that he did and saw. Much of it also remains classified. He was in Southeast Asia with MACV SOG. Some of you have never heard of it, but those of you who have might remember it stood for Military Assistance Command Vietnam Studies and Observations Group. But before we get into all that, let's get at least a little taste of his pre-military life.
Well, you remember how good and easy life was, how you were outside running around playing all the time. You were never inside playing games and stuff. You were out with your friends playing baseball, playing hide-and-seek, getting in trouble, whatever there was to do, we did it. I grew up with friends that are still friends. As a matter of fact, we went through grade school and high school together, and most of them were in our wedding, and those that are still alive, we are in contact with all the time.
Do you remember as a boy having some big ideas of, hey, when I grow up, these are the kinds of things I'm going to do?
Well, yeah, I think every young man has dreams, whether it's sports or whatever. I wanted to be an engineer. And I thought maybe I'd go to MIT and become an engineer. And you know how those things drift apart. When Maggie and I started dating, I was more set on staying around her and stuff. So instead of going to engineering school, I went to Illinois Wesleyan and became a physics major there.
And this is about the time that America is getting more and more involved in Vietnam. Was there a time when it registered for you that military service was going to be part of your future?
No, not at all. For a number of reasons, we got married between our junior and senior year. Very fortunate, I thought. My wife found out that there was a reserve unit in our hometown that I could go and sign up for and do that, which I did. Things sort of evolved from there. I got very involved in military for some reason. I took a field manual and read every one of them and took classes through Fort Benning and passed their commission course. I went down to Benning for an IOBC, an infantry officer basic course, became commissioned. Well, that started the whole difference, because when I went back, I couldn't go to the unit that I left, because you can't go back as an officer if you left as an enlisted person. So I was transferred to a military intelligence unit in Chicago. And from there, my whole life changed.
And I know there are going to be some elements of your story that even after all these years, you're not allowed to talk about. But this new book that's coming out, First Shot, is going to tell some of the story. When people see your Vietnam veteran hat, or they see your jump wings that are pinned on there, or the CIA pin, or the combat infantry badge, or your MACV SOG pin, how do you explain what you were doing during those years?
Well, it took me 45 years to even talk about it. My wife noticed there was a difference. She had no idea where I was going. My summer camps were different than anybody else's summer camps. My training, weekend training, was different. I probably should have been more aware of what I was doing, but it was so interesting to learn the things that I was being taught, whether it was surveillance techniques or video surveillance and air surveillance, and be able to read maps and stuff that were taken from thousands of feet in the air, being trained in a lot of different jungle techniques, whether it was how to travel through the jungle, how to eat in the jungle, or whatever it might have been, and just never realized what that was going to involve into. But it did. We just went on with the program, and when our agency asked me if I was willing to train with them, there would be no difference. I would still just be a reservist, basically, going to two-week summer camps and one weekend a month into training.
And then at some point, I guess that changed.
Yeah, sure did. There are a lot of things that were happening. MACV-SOG, as you're aware of, is a very highly classified division, and it was all types of military people, Green Beret, and everybody volunteered. The CIA had involvement in it, and they sent their people and even their military people that were actually Army, Air Force, Marines, whatever it could be, to train with these people and do missions with these people. I was never involved in the big, you know, the Tet Offensive or anything like that. That wasn't what I was trained for, and I wasn't deployed to Vietnam for any length of time. I was deployed to an aircraft carrier in the South China Sea, and the missions that I ran were to go to POW camps and try to get our POWs out, or if pilots and planes had gone down what we called over the fence or out of bounds where we weren't supposed to operate, I would take my detachments in there and try to rescue these pilots and POWs.
And just hearing you describe that, and you're describing it so matter-of-factly, but I think anybody who's got any familiarity with what things were like there is saying, boy, those are pretty dangerous missions. You're taking your life into your hands every time you even think about doing something like that. Was that something that weighed on you, especially knowing you had a wife back home in the States?
It weighed on me, but not nearly as much as the deception and the lies that I had to tell. We've been married 58 years, and she didn't know until just not that long ago. And it took her a while to digest it. Our kids and my friends, it was, you know, some of the stuff was, and I haven't told that many people. I don't go out and publicize it. Some of it came out because I took over as commander of our veterans group, and it's still tough sometimes.
Understandably so, and I don't want to take that lightly or for granted, because 45 years is a long time to keep a secret and to carry that burden. And I'm sure there are some other people out there listening who've had to do similar things. And there are guys who went the rest of their lives and never talked about some of the things they did. Can you help us understand what that burden feels like when there are people that you love, that you care about, that you just, for whatever reason, can't share what is weighing on you?
Well, first of all, when I decided to make this my military deal, you know, we were told, you know, we're not going to get recognition, we're not going to get rewarded, nobody's going to know about what we're doing and stuff. And at that time, I think, yeah, well, this is what we're studying, we're training at these camps that the agency runs. You know, I'm just saying, well, that's just stuff you don't talk about. Going to war was quite a bit different. And yes, I was scared. There's no question about it. I was afraid for my wife finding out if something happened to me. I don't know when I heard about it or read about it, but it's published someplace that 100% of MACV-SOG volunteers were either killed in action or wounded in action. Had I known that, I'm sure I would never have agreed to do what I did. But I worked with the best trained people and professional soldiers. I know it was my duty to take care of them, but they took care of me. They did their best to keep me out of harm's way. A few times my NCOIC would yell at me, get the hell, sit down, get down, don't stand up, and, you know, stay back. Sometimes you can't do that when you see people fighting for their lives. And you just, you know, you make decisions to do things that if you've sat and thought about it for any length of time, you might not do. I got kidded. I don't know what deployment it was on, that I held two records in Vietnam, one for crying and one for vomiting. It was a miserable place.
Yeah, and I don't want to take that lightly. I realize this is not going to be easy to talk about all this. And one thing I don't want to forget to ask, when you say that you carried those secrets for so long, what was the trigger? What was the motivation or the freeing moment where finally it was okay to talk about a little of it.
First of all, I don't know how okay it was, but it just, my wife's an RN, and she knew I had things on my mind, and she told me, you know, you need to talk about it. And when I'd see guys in the military and guys that had been to Vietnam wearing hats and this and that, you know, I'd thank them for their service, and we'd start talking. You know, I might say, well, yeah, I was attached to MACV SOG, and what did you do? Well, they knew I wasn't going to talk about it much, but I just started loosening up and started loosening up. Then I went in and researched and see what we could talk about. So much of it's redacted. You just need to be careful. And the more my wife found out, the more she tried to get me to talk about it, because she thought it might relieve some of my nightmares, some of my temper problems, because there were things that bothered me. And it did. So when you start hanging around military people, sometimes you just talk about stuff. Never talked about anything that I don't think I shouldn't have. Maybe some of the things, but not where at, and naturally none of the people involved. But that's kind of what got me to write a book, too. I've written a few books in the past, but never seriously tried to get them published or anything. But writing this book, it's a load off my back, because I told things. I mean, you know, I'd wake up in the middle of the night in a sweat, because remembering things that I didn't want to remember. I think it's relieved that quite a bit. I was very fortunate last April to go on honor flight to Washington, D.C., which I understand you know about. And first of all, I think every veteran there is should go on honor flight. That's quite a, I mean, whether you served out of country in a war zone, whether you just stayed here, every veteran deserves the right to go on honor flight, because it's for everyone. And the people that were sitting at a desk the whole time, or training or whatever, they get just as much out of it as somebody, and sometimes more than people that have been deployed to war zones. I've talked to so many people and met a number of people that have been to war that couldn't face it. And I'm sure you understand the suicides from veterans is just unacceptable. I'm a chicken, so I haven't really thought about suicide. But I can see where people that don't let this out of their system can really be haunted with nightmares and stuff. It's kind of the reason I wrote the book.
And I definitely want to come back to your honor flight experience and hear what some of the highlights of that were. But as you talked about the nightmares, and I've talked to so many veterans over the years who experienced this, mostly World War II guys. My grandfather, you know, saw some things that to his dying day he was having flashbacks and nightmares. How frequent of an experience was that for you? And, you know, for those of us who haven't experienced that, I don't know if we can truly understand, but maybe you can help us understand a little.
I'll tell you what, really, my father was 54 when I was born. It was his second marriage, and he was in World War I. And he had an old trunk down the basement in our house. And I used to go down there and try to go through it and find things and ask him about it. And he didn't want to talk about it. And I never understood why, you know, because I thought it was neat. There are a lot of things in life that change us. War is one of the worst. Divorces, probably deaths of children or something like that. I've found out that if you don't get it off your back, it's just tough. Being able to talk about what I did was impossible for a long time. And until I found some people that were also in the same situation that I was and could talk about it, I mean, I wouldn't even, I even accepted into for military help, because this stuff was that classified. And being deployed by the agency even made it more classified. I had a lot of friends that came back from Vietnam that had really changed. They never wanted to talk about it. I understand why. But I think if they'd have gotten professional help to talk about it, I think they would have been a lot better. But as you well know, the suicides from that war are unacceptable.
Studies suggest roughly 100,000 Vietnam veterans have committed suicide in the half century since that war ended. And I think we can all agree even one is too many. There are so many more avenues of help available today than there used to be. One of them is the Veterans and Military Crisis Line. So if you or someone you know is struggling, call 988 and then press 1. That's 988 and press 1. It's time for our first break, but there's much more to come with Greg Schiffbauer of Henderson, Nevada. He's the author of the new book, First Shot, detailing his experiences with MACV SOG during the Vietnam War. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 2,000 veterans will have visited their memorials for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with Vietnam veteran Greg Schiffbauer of Henderson, Nevada, a native of Normal, Illinois. Much of what he did in Southeast Asia remains classified. In fact, he had to submit his new book, First Shot, to an intelligence review panel to make sure he wasn't publishing anything he wasn't supposed to. And for decades, even his wife Maggie had no idea what he'd been doing over there. He even had cover stories he was forced to tell. But when MACV SOG received the Presidential Unit Citation in 2003, he started to open up a little, a process that led to this new book.
Maybe by you writing the book, by you sharing your story in moments like this, maybe you'll encourage some other guys to take that leap of faith to share. I think it seems like, you know, my impression has been one of the reasons to keep it to yourself is being convinced that no one could possibly get it, right? That no one's really going to understand what you were really doing or how it really worked.
I don't know if you're familiar with MAC SOG, but it was a volunteer group made up of basically there were members from all services. Most of them were Green Beret or Navy SEALs even back then, and lifetime or lifers that just really enjoyed the action. And I don't mean that as bad, because I don't know how anybody could really enjoy it, but they wanted to be part of it. I served with some guys, I mean, that were true heroes. I mean, true heroes. I don't know how many decorations I submitted. I don't know how many were granted, but you know, you start talking about it, and you start remembering it, and you start remembering, and I say, your friends, we didn't even know last names, you know. Well, and sometimes we did, but you never knew what happened to them, if they got out or not. MACV SOG didn't have a very good lifetime rate. the numbers were incredible for not just killed in action, but wounded in action, and I lost good guys.
And as you say that, you know, you lost good guys. I'm just assuming that there were some times where it really could have been you, and it was pretty close to being you. And maybe some of those are what we might read in this book?
Well, yeah. There were a couple times my NCOIC would lecture me. There's been times that I've been grabbed by the shirt collar and yanked to the ground. When you're in the field and you're out there to lead people, they want you to stay there to lead them. They don't want you shot. You know, and you can't not respond when you see something, though. You can't not respond. Those times, too many people don't think of their own lives. They just go do what they think they have to do to protect somebody. And, you know, you lose good men. And too many times you lose good men you can't bring home.
And I get that distinction there. Yeah. Some of whom are still over there, I'm sure. How much of a picture can you paint for us of one of these missions? I'm trying to picture it in your mind. You said you're aboard an aircraft carrier, but when you receive word of hostages that you could go rescue, POWs that you can set free, or down pilots that are in need of rescue, how big a team would go in? How would you get there? Maybe walk us through one of those missions.
Well, normally, myself, I'd have an NCOIC. There would be 9, 12, sometimes if it's a big thing, we would be joined with other groups. But depending where we were going, if we were out of bounds, we took the smallest groups that we possibly could. And there, you know, we'd deploy close to borders, and then we would move to wherever we had to move. Some POW camps were not in Vietnam. They were in other countries that were housing them.
Which America was not supposed to be in.
That's right. And so we were there to try to get those guys back. Planes went down in countries that didn't allow us. We would get the coordinates of where the plane went down and do our very best to get as close as possible, you know, to rescue them if they were still alive. Sometimes the enemy would get there first. They wouldn't normally kill anybody. They'd strap them into the plane or something if they were in there so they couldn't move, couldn't yell, couldn't talk, and then set the plane to blow up if somebody tried to rescue them. We've learned that the hard way. But, you know, we weren't just fighting the Vietnamese at times. We were fighting the communists. It's hard to believe that other...
You've been exposed to situations that defy most of our expectations of how humanity should act. And I'm, again, I don't want you to share anything that you're not comfortable sharing. But when you say you learned it the hard way, so you went to rescue downed air crews or pilots and saw that happen, booby traps,
sure,
claiming the lives not just of the people in the plane, but some of your guys trying to rescue them. I just can't imagine how devastating that's got to be.
Well, war's hell. I don't know who said that first, but they were right. And, you know, it wasn't a popular war. And so most of us just would never talk about it because people didn't care. You go to do something, you do the best you can, and you try to come home safe. Too many times, too many people didn't come home safe. Of the thousands of people we lost in Southeast Asia, you know, I don't know how many were killed by enemy and how many were killed by friendly fire, because you never knew what was going on. I know that we had one trip in there that we had gotten some people to go with us to guide us that were double-crossing us. Thank God our linguist overheard them talking in their own language, and we knew what was going on and prepared for that. Over there, you didn't know who to trust. You didn't know who your real allies were. You know, we had treaties with countries we weren't allowed to go into, no matter what, and they were allies of ours, and they might have been hiding some of our captives. Not their government necessarily, but other people that were in there. It was just a situation that a lot of books have claimed we never should have been there. Well, we were there, and we were there to help a country that needed help. And, you know, we followed the French in, who left us high and dry, but it wasn't a pleasant place, that's for sure.
Yeah, and I know you carry those devastating moments and the tragic moments, but seems like the other side of that coin has to bring some satisfaction. And I'm guessing we can read some of that in the book as well. Are there some moments you look back on where your crew was able to accomplish what you set out to do?
Oh, absolutely. You know, we rescued out of POW camps over 50 people, out of downed aircraft, maybe 10 or 12 people. The biggest problem is we lost too many people because of that. Sometimes we blame the leader. Well, I was the leader. Maybe we shouldn't have lost all those people. But my NCOs told me I did a good job. And they did their best to keep me alive. And I tried to do my best to keep them alive. And that's all I can say.
Well, I'm just imagining that every one of those rescued POWs, every one of those pilots that didn't think they were ever going to get home, that did, probably have a whole lot of gratitude in their hearts for what you guys did. Did you ever get to come face to face with that, with just how much gratitude, how grateful they were for the danger you guys endured to get them home?
Well, mostly after we got them out of harm's way, they usually went to a hospital, the sanctuary ship or something that was there. They were debriefed and stuff, and they never knew us. I mean, they saw our faces, they saw what we did, but they, you know, our names, they never would have known our names. They never would have. We were a ghost crew.
Well, it'll be interesting to see as people read this book if any of those folks are still alive. Some of these things may ring a bell for them. And speaking of the book, so the title, First Shot, what is that referring to?
Well, First Shot actually refers to the first shot, the first kill I made in Vietnam. And it wasn't on my first mission. I had to get hardened. And I thought I could shoot, but I was with such capable people, but they had my back. If I was assigned to shoot at somebody and I didn't shoot, somebody else was behind me to do it. Until you get that first one done, it's tough. Not saying it's any tougher to go on from there, but I did a lot of crying. And I lost a lot of dinners. So,
and what I'm hearing you say, and correct me if I'm wrong, is just that reality that so many veterans have wrestled with, that what you're asked to do, what your orders are, what your mission is going to cost someone on the other side his life. That's what was hard for you to stomach.
That's what we were hoping. we were hoping to come out of it clean, you know, with everybody we went to get. Of course, we never knew how many people we were going to get, but we did our best to get as many people back and get them back safe as we could. We lost people doing it. We lost some of the ones we rescued. But, you know, for every guy you brought back safe, that's one guy that's happy. For every guy you lost, there's 100 people that are unhappy. And that's a tough reality to look at.
Especially when you can't receive consolation from your wife. And I'm just thinking about that. What was your cover story? What did she think you were doing over there?
She thought I was just doing summer camps and stuff like that. And, you know, I always said, well, I'm going early. I'm, you know, setting up and this and that. So I was gone longer than I was, you know, normally would be gone. I was in, the advanced team and stuff like that. She never questioned it, but she saw a change in me and never questioned that.
How big a difference has it made now that you've been able to talk some about it and are writing this book in terms of when the two of you are around each other? I'm just wondering what her view on all this might be.
Well, she read it.
Yeah.
She read the manuscript, and it took her a while to digest. But she knew that questions bothered me, especially questions I couldn't answer. So she was very good about, you know, not trying to She's a little upset I didn't tell her this stuff, but that's, you know, that was the duty. And even to today, so much of it's classified that, you know, you've got to work around that and make sure that everything goes through a, you know, a publication audit for security review. I found a thing on MacVSOG that was written up, and it, half of it's redacted. I mean, you skip from one word to the next paragraph sometimes. And it's just, you know, I don't know how much of that will become unclassified. It doesn't really matter to me. I don't care about the awards. I don't care about anything other than the fact we did our best to bring people home.
Because of some of the secrecy around MacVSOG operations, there's no official total of those rescued by their efforts, but you can imagine each one holds special significance for those involved, like Greg Schiffbauer, author of the book First Shot, which we have linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com and the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. It's time now for our final break, but when we come back, what did Greg do to earn the Silver Star? And also the man who wrote the foreword to his book in a bit of a small world connection to a previous guest here on Hometown Heroes who finished his days pretty close to where Greg lives now in Las Vegas. Thanks to Honor Flight of Southern Nevada for connecting us to Greg, and Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
When prices start going up, we all look for ways to save. So here's a simple message for you. Look no further than EECU. Did you know you can finance your mortgage through EECU? How about a home equity line of credit? EECU makes HELOC loans easy. And when the car business is all over the map, the auto loan rates are as steady as can be. EECU is a not-for-profit credit union, not a bank. So the members always win. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today or call 1-800-538-3328. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend, it's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with Greg Schiffbauer of Henderson, Nevada, author of the new book, First Shot, about his secret operations in Southeast Asia with MacVSOG.
And you mentioned, you know, awards. And I've interviewed Medal of Honor recipients and guys who got the Distinguished Service Cross and the Air Force Cross, Navy Cross. I understand you're a recipient of a medal that's next in line there that my grandfather received in World War II, the Silver Star. Can you tell us about what made you part of that very exclusive club?
Well, my NCO, I see, is the one that nominated me for it. And he was killed in action. His next in command is the one that sent everything through. And it was for a mission that I really can't talk about because someplace we weren't supposed to be. But one of my men stood up to fire at a enemy helicopter that was attacking us as we were trying to move troops out. And not even... you don't think in the field sometimes very well. And it's just that I got a man down out of fire and got up, took it sniper out of the tree and then turned around and unloaded into the helicopter that was attacking our men while they were all hiding. I was lucky I made it away. That's all I know.
Well, it sounds like it. And again, I wasn't there, and I'm just listening to you and trying to picture it. It sounds like in that moment, you decided that you were going to put yourself in more danger to potentially save the lives of the guys with you, and it sounds like that's what happened.
Yeah, that's basically what I did.
Have you ever relived that moment and thought about why or what you'd do differently?
Yeah, you relive moments like that, like, you know, what the hell's wrong with you type of thing. But in those moments, common sense isn't always the right thing. You know, I've met Medal of Honor recipients. I know three of them pretty well. It's amazing what somebody will do to save somebody without even thinking about it. You know, I think of people like David Bellavia in Iraq. They do amazing things. I mean, there's corpsmen out there that have received the Medal of Honor. You know, these guys aren't even armed.
But they're in just as much danger, if not more so. Well, I hope that people are going to order this book and read all about it. You mentioned that the foreword of your book was written by someone whose name some of our listeners might recognize, but you can explain the connections that make his name well-known and also the connection to you.
Well, yeah, George Patton Waters. He's the grandson of General George Patton II, who the World War II general that pretty much everybody knows his name. But his father was also General John Waters, who had a very distinctive career of his own. Matter of fact, he was a POW in Europe. And from what I know, one story, they were being moved to another camp. One of the POWs couldn't move, so they were just going to shoot him. General Waters said, "No, don't." He said, "I'll carry him to the other camp." And they just kind of laughed and said, "Well, if you can carry him, we don't care." You know, and he did. That's pretty amazing.
And if you're a longtime Hometown Heroes listener with a really good memory, you might be experiencing a little deja vu, or at least feeling like you've heard a story like this before. If so, it's because you have. A decade ago, right there in Las Vegas where Greg lives, we met a World War II veteran named Alan Dunbar, an ex-prisoner of war who credited the man Greg was just talking about, General Patton's son-in-law, John Waters, with saving his life. Here's some of what Mr. Dunbar shared with us in 2015.
Was there anything about your interrogation that stood out to you?
Well, not my particular interrogation. It was the manner in which this man, Lieutenant Colonel John Waters, became a person of renown to me because he saved my life. We met at Oflag 64 in Poland.
This is where you were a prisoner. So this is, they've taken you there in one of those cattle cars, the 40 and 8s, packing three or four times as many people as should be in there.
181 officers are there.
Wow.
They were standing up.
So you're taken to Poland, and you're in this prison camp.
Right.
How was the food?
The food, they received German Red Cross parcels. The German guards, they would take all the food out, put it in one pile, mix it all up, and then they'd give it to the prisoners. You couldn't eat it. It was like slop.
Ruined it. You must have lost a lot of weight.
I weighed 102 pounds when I was liberated.
Wow. I bet you ate some things that you never would have stomached before.
Oh, I told some of the prisoners, don't eat the slop. Now, I'm not blaming you if you eat it, because we're not getting anything to eat from the Germans.
Right.
Maybe some kartoffels or something, bread.
Was that the bread made out of sawdust?
Yeah. And then Colonel Waters, an enlisted man, comes up and he says, "Captain, Colonel Waters wants to talk to you." So I knew Colonel Waters was head of the camp. He calls me in, and I was going to salute him. He says, "No saluting in this camp." He says, "I heard that you're a pretty good man." I didn't say a word to him. So he said to me, "How would you like to work for me in the camp?" I said, "I would like to do that, Colonel." He says, I want you to call me by my first name. I'm John Waters. And I knew who he was.
Did you know who his father-in-law was?
Yeah. I says, you happen to be General Patton's son-in-law? He says, yes. He says, how did you know? I says, well, I know the Patton family from before the war and during the war. And I was not impressed with his command ability. He looked at me and he says, well, why weren't you impressed? He was a three-star general. I said, yes, and they took one star away from him because of the way he treated the enlisted men who were wounded and then in the hospital. So he says, oh, you're one of those guys. I said, yes. He says, well, he says, you and I are going to be good friends, I could see. He says, I don't like him either. I said, he's your father-in-law. He says, I think that you are an honest person. I want you to work for me. Oh, one other thing. My name is John, and you're Alan. That's what we're going to talk. No rank.
Right.
I said, yes, sir. He said, no, sir. He made rules as he went along. He made rules.
So what kind of work did he have you doing there in the camp?
He had me go around to the officers in the 422nd and the 423rd, the officers who were POWs, mm-hmm. and he wanted me to tell them he is doing everything possible to get them released and sent back to their families and the American troops.
What was the hardest thing about being a prisoner? What was the most challenging part of that for you?
The hardest thing in being a POW was the lack of freedom. When you're used to doing what you please most of the time, your freedom is so important to you, and your lack of communication with your family.
Did you ever hear from them in captivity?
The mail that they sent was either destroyed or the Germans just threw them away.
So you never knew whether or not your family knew you were alive.
That's right.
But did they?
Yeah.
They knew you were reported missing and reported captured?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
They got it through the grapevine, I guess. I was working for this man.
For Waters, yeah.
Yeah. I had to report to him of everything I saw during the prisoner of war camp that I thought was wrong. Some of the prisoners were trying to escape without him knowing about it. That's not right.
Probably wasn't smart either.
Wasn't smart either. Of course, you get yourself killed.
Exactly.
That way.
Yeah. Did you ever, during those months of captivity, while you're starving, you're losing weight, did you ever think you were going to die there, that you wouldn't be free again?
I never thought about that.
Why not? What gave you hope?
Hope because I was an American, and I felt that someday they would become better trained and they would liberate either the camp or they would win the war.
Mm-hmm.
I never had any doubts in my mind that the Americans would win the war. There were a lot of rumors going around.
About the Russians?
About the Russians.
And you didn't want to get captured by them, did you?
No.
Or liberated by
no.
them? Because that would be being captured by them.
Yeah. So we were very happy when they kept going to the west.
Mm-hmm.
We went to the prisoner of war camp called Habelberg. It was in Germany.
They moved you to get you away from the advancing Russians?
Right.
Okay.
And advancing Russians and the German army, too, that was in Europe. So Colonel Waters was the type of individual that you could trust.
Mm-hmm.
With anything you might have to say.
Right.
I learned that very early in being with him. He was very honest with me, and he said something to me that I started to laugh because I thought it was funny. He says, oh, by the way, since I'm a graduate of West Point, he says, I'll probably end up as a general. And I said to him, I said, you and I have an agreement. We only talk to each other by our first names. And if you become a general, you mean to tell me you're not going to expect me to say, call you a general? He says, yeah, you and I are friends. You're Alan. I'm John.
So he got wounded in the transition between camps?
Yeah. Here's what happened.
Yep.
We were at Hamelburg. We were ready to be sent to this camp in Moochburg.
Right.
Which was north of where we were. So Patton sent a task force to Hamelburg to liberate the camp and liberate his son-in-law.
Right.
The task force got beat up.
It was a failed attempt.
Failed attempt. And Waters decides to go out and greet the men who was sent by Patton to liberate the camp. But they didn't liberate the camp. They all got captured.
So they get captured trying to liberate them, and he goes out to meet the new prisoners that are coming in, that were the guys that were supposed to liberate it?
Yeah. Uh-huh. And guess what? Somebody shot him in the back. A German guard shot
Waters in the
back. Mm-hmm. He was critically wounded. So when I saw him after he had been wounded, I said to him, I said, you have a wound that's either going to kill you or is it going to really, you'll really be disabled. I said, John, I said, this is the worst wound you can have. You're shot in the back. That bullet is lodged up against your spine.
Mm-hmm.
I saw the hole in the back. I mean, I don't know how he was talking to me. So he said, Alan, he said, I guess this is going to be a parting of the ways. I said, John, I said, I'm praying to God that you survive. So he said, I'll see you in heaven.
And I know you're both still looking forward to that meeting, but he would make it home safely. You've been in touch with his family over the years, and you've been very clear how much John Waters meant to you. This is the man, when they were marching you to Hamelburg and your feet were so swollen you couldn't even walk, he convinced the Germans to take you in the meat wagon that they used for all the wounded. The same guy who would come get you from that wagon and carry you to the barn so you could sleep at night. And it sounds like he just had the kind of monumental impact on your life that you seem eternally grateful for.
I didn't think that I would have lived. He, being the son-in-law of this man, carried weight with the Germans. He was like a god to the Germans.
Patton was.
Patton was.
Yeah.
That he couldn't be killed. That he was from the way back in history.
Well, that's what he believed. Patton believed he was Napoleon and Julius Caesar reincarnated.
Right.
Yeah.
And the Germans believed that.
We're almost out of time, but I need to hear the story of your liberation and what that felt like for you.
Oh, well, we finally get into Moochburg.
Right.
Patton sent another task force to liberate Moochburg. And he did.
So you saw the tanks come through the gate.
I saw the tanks up through the tank gate, and I saw the troops coming in, and I saw the Germans throwing their arms down, and I said, we're free. And then this guy comes into the camp.
General Patton comes right into the camp in Moochburg.
He comes into Moochburg. He's riding a jeep that's painted gold. And he's in there, and he's got his feet like this. He's got jumpers on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those pants that they...
He was famous for them, yeah.
And two silver revolvers, silver helmet with three stars up there. And he's got this batter on, and he tells the men, he calls them all. He says, I hope you can hear me. 1,500 Allied soldiers, American soldiers, you are going home. I am liberating you. You're going aboard 100 planes. We'll be here to pick you up. And some character goes out there, screw that. I want to get on a plane now. And everybody, all the POWs, they started to laugh. 47s. Half the POWs, they were dressed like bums.
Well, sure.
I mean, we looked like bums. I mean, I hadn't shaved in who knows when. I had a beard and everything. I was afraid to go on the plane. got to France.
Right.
They flew us to France. They examined us.
Yeah.
To see whether we were fit to go home.
Right.
Or fit to go on board the ship. There was a ship waiting in the harbor.
What was the American port that you came into?
First, we landed in New York Harbor.
Did you sail past something that had some significance there?
Statue of Liberty.
So they took you right past Lady Liberty.
They put Liberty, and then we docked in New Brunswick.
Mm-hmm.
And they put us on buses and took us home.
What did that mean to you? You told me that the hardest thing about being a prisoner was just living in the absence of freedom. And then you sail past the symbol of freedom and liberty. What did that mean to you to see that again?
Well, it meant that a lot of people died for us to get home. And I thought about them. And I thought about my family. What are they going to feel about me being a POW?
And are they even going to recognize you?
Yeah, I only weighed 102 pounds.
So you got to go home and see your mother and
yes,
your father?
I got home to see my mother and father. And my mother was beside herself. And she said, I knew she was going to say it. She said, the only thing missing is your brother Joe. And he died a hero's death.
Alan's brother Joe had been killed when an Italian submarine sank his ship in the Mediterranean. But the Dunbar family would have had two Gold Star heroes if not for the courage and heroism of John Waters, who Greg Schiffbauer was telling us about. And it's John Waters' son who, in the foreword to Greg's new book, First Shot, writes, I am convinced my grandfather, General George Patton Jr., would count Greg among the heroic alive ones. I hope you'll be moved by his inspiring story.
Pat Waters, he goes by Pat Waters, his name is George Patton Waters, is the grandson of General George Patton and the son of General John Waters. His mother was General Patton's daughter, and he has a distinguished military career of his own. He was a Navy officer. And I've got a story, and I hope he won't mind if I tell it, because the reason he goes by Pat Waters is one day his grandfather was at their house to visit, and Pat was a young kid at the time and was scared of his grandfather because General Patton talked tough and loud and stuff. And so he hid under the bed with his dog. And General Patton came in to find him and reached under the bed, and the dog bit him. And he went and took care of his finger and came back, and he said, nobody, the name George Patton's going to hide under a bed. So he started going by Pat. And but, you know, he's the most wonderful person. He's a person that you meet once in your life and you think you've been a friend for the rest of your entire life. Just a wonderful person. He and his wife, Martha, are incredible.
And they say the same about Greg Schiffbauer, whose book, First Shot, is now available on Amazon. We've got that link for you at hometownheroesradio.com, as well as the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. And it's clear that we're going to have to continue this conversation on our next episode because we haven't even gotten into the powerful experience Greg had in Washington, D.C. with Honor Flight Southern Nevada. We'll explore that and more next time when we're reminded again through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.